So let's start. Last time we discussed the effect of inept sequences, and the reason why we needed to discuss inept sequences was the fact that NMR of proton or NMR of carbon have very different signal-to-noise. You remember that the signal-to-noise was proportional to gamma of the excited spin and times gamma of the detected spin to the power of 3/2. And so the gammas of carbon is only 1/4 of the gamma of proton, so the carbon sensitivity is substantially lower than the proton sensitivity. And that led to the idea, why can't we, can we probably do something that we start excite magnetization on the proton and then transfer this to the carbon? And that actually would, I mean, you can imagine that you do that one step, so you excite proton, detect carbon, and then you would gain a factor of 4 in the signal-to-noise. And such experiments you have got to know in organic chemistry practical work, and these were called dept or inept. These were proton excited proton excited carbon detected 1D experiments, and they give you better signal to noise. Now, of course, you can also think, when you have a method by which you can transfer magnetization from proton to carbon, due to the fact that protons and carbons are J-coupled, maybe you can do this back again from carbon to proton. And then you would also gain the gamma beta detection. But of course, so then you can do that also in a 1D, but if you want to combine both effects, you go from proton to carbon and carbon to proton, then in order to get the carbon chemical shift, that is what you want, then you need to make a 2D experiment. And so schemes that actually exploit the J-based magnetization transfer from proton to carbon to proton, the 2Ds that you also have already heard the names are HSQC, HMQC. Those two experiments yield identical information, just variations, and HMBC. So these two yield information on in situations where you have a proton and a spin X, so it cannot only be carbon, but it can also be nitrogen and, you know, whatever, wherever protons can be bound. And the correlation goes or exploits 1J couplings. And the HMBC exploits 2J or 3J couplings between protons and carbons. So it is a long-range heteronuclear correlation. So just the abbreviations, you don't really need to know. So I just tell them. Heteronuclear single quantum coherence spectroscopy, heteronuclear multi-quantum coherence spectroscopy and HMBC, that's probably important, heteronuclear multiple bond coherence spectroscopy. So this is how you can memorize that HMBC is for 2 and 3J couplings. And just one word on J couplings, size of J couplings, CH. They can be between 130 hertz and 250 hertz, while the long range couplings or the multiple bond couplings, CH, are of the order between 1 and 10 or 0 and 10 hertz. So there's one order of magnitude, factor of 10, one order of magnitude difference in the size of the J couplings, which means that in an HSQC and an HMQC, by setting the delays very short, you get only very little of the long range coupling. So, I mean, if you match a experiment to match this coupling, then the transfer due to the smaller coupling is only 10% or even less. Yeah, so that is why in HSQCs you only see one J coupling, because they are so much larger. And this is why I tell. And similarly, for nitrogen, the 1J coupling is 90 hertz, and the 2J NH couplings are sort of probably 0 to 5 hertz. We could go on with the size of the couplings, but that's, kind of also boring, of course, you know, because you're going to forget about it anyway. But when you have synthesized somewhere, when you have synthesized a compound like containing fluorine has large couplings, or you have synthesized a compound containing silicon, then you should look into textbooks or scan the internet and see what are the possible sizes of couplings in these compounds, because then you can maybe able to do some experiments which then help you to determine the constitution of your molecule that you have synthesized. So, I mean, this is all information eventually you need if you have your own molecules in hand. And so this is just, you have to do research on them. But often it's also then known in the Arbeitskreis where you go, of course. So the idea now is to discuss today the HSQC experiment. We have discussed the INEPT last time. And now we put it together and discuss the HSQC experiment. And by doing so, we also repeat, of course, the INEPT. It's a 2D experiment. It's a heteronuclear experiment. So you have two channels are represented by two vertical lines. If you apply pulses to 3 nuclei, you have 3 channels, 4 nuclei, you have 4 channels, and so forth and so forth. So each of the vertical lines represents one nucleus. So we take, for example, a proton-carbon HSQC, but it could be any other NMR-active nucleus. let's say, spin one half nucleus. If it's other spin, then it may be more complicated. So we have 90 degree pulses and 180 degree pulses, and you see that this was the inept module, or in German we would say Baustein, and then this is a reverse inept. These pulses are separated by delays. And the pulses have phases. X, Y, X, X, Y. And for the pulses where I don't specify, phases, the phases are not so important. Certainly not in the discussion that we have now here. You see that I put these times and delays at different places in the diagram, and they're always written at places or above the line that the spin is transverse. So in this period of time, the protons are transverse. The xy plane, then the carbon is in the xy plane and the proton is not, and then it's the proton again. And you see that we had discussed this before, but I just repeat, we sometimes use Greek letters and sometimes we use Roman letters, and the Greek letters specify times that are identical from experiment to experiment. They always keep the same. And the Roman letters, they are being incremented in experiments. So this is why we use different kinds of letters. And now the way you analyze that is to look at time periods for which you have to calculate the effect of J coupling and chemical shift. So you analyze the pulse sequence. And by repeating this, it would be nice if you would start to understand how you have to analyze such a pulse sequence. Maybe I should say a word. So if you develop pulse sequences yourself, then you need to know that. And Robin actually has done her bachelor thesis in our lab and has developed pulse sequences. So, and we have new pulse sequences that we will write up and publish. So then you need to know how you actually apply all these pulses. If you're not going to be part of an NMR group or EPR group, then of course you also forget about this. So then at some point it's no longer important. But then take it as an exercise that you have done for a couple of lectures to understand how you can actually develop such things. It is an exercise. I mean, it is not. You will not in 3 years' time, if you are a synthetic chemist, you don't know how you can analyze an NMR sequence anymore. It's also not what you need to know for long. But here, it is interesting, or we believe it is interesting, that for this period of time, you really understand how that would work. Yeah, as sort of an impression. Similarly, I'm an NMR spectroscopist, and I couldn't care less how you put some molecules on the surface of a chip. You know, I also accept this as a fact, but of course I have learned it, or I have gotten a feeling for this at some point during my education. So you learn a lot of things that later you don't need anymore. Okay. So what we have to do is we have to analyze the sequence, and therefore we put blocks where we have to calculate the effects of J coupling and chemical shift. So, and we write this again by putting little A's, B's, C's, and D's in the pile sequence. So we have a point before any pulse is being applied. And so this is before the experiment actually starts. So this is point A, and then comes a pulse, and then we have a period between B and C, and then come two pulses, and then comes a period D and E, then come two pulses, F and G, and then comes detection. Yeah, so I calculate, I define, I set what kind of start magnetization I have at A. Then I calculate the effect of the pulse. Then I calculate what happens between B and C, pulse, D and E, pulse, F and G, detection. I mean, we have done this also for the NOSI, and now we do it the same kind of things for the HSQC. So at point A, we have placed our NMR tube in the magnet, and so after T1, it will have equilibrium magnetization, and that we abbreviate with HZ magnetization. This is equilibrium magnetization. And in principle for brackets, if you have ethanol, then you have, then this HZ is 1 times H1Z plus 2 H2Z plus 3 H3Z, because all the H3s are chemically identical, magnetically identical, all the H2s are identical, and the H1 is 1H1. And if you have 1,000 protons, then you know you have 1,000 protons. Okay, so this is HZ. So then we apply the 90-degree pulse. And now we have to define the flip angle of the pulse. It is most often 90, but it can also be everything in between 0 and 180. The phase and the channel that we apply it for. So then we get minus HY. Now, minus HY now experiences a sequence delta half to 180 degree pulses delta half. And is seeing proton chemical shift, proton carbon J coupling, and probably other couplings. So we have to analyze, and that is what we did the last time and two lectures ago, what happens in such an echo sequence. So, what happens in an echo sequence with proton chemical shift, with carbon chemical shift, with proton-carbon coupling with proton-proton coupling. With carbon-carbon coupling. Now, proton chemical shift is refocused. I mean, I don't write now down all the mathematical equations because we have done this. But I'll just write down the results. So this is refocused. I don't have to care for it. Carbon chemical shift is irrelevant at this point because I only have protons transverse. The carbons are not transverse, so I don't have to care whether they can evolve chemical shift because they're not transverse. If they were transverse, it would be refocused. But they are not, so it's irrelevant. Proton-carbon coupling evolves for delta. Proton-proton coupling evolves for delta. They also evolve. In the description of the pulse sequence, they are neglected. They are neglected because the size of the proton-proton couplings is maximum 12 hertz. The size of the proton-carbon coupling is 150 hertz. And so because they are small, you can kind of neglect the effect of the proton-proton coupling. But they evolve. You cannot suppress it. And now carbon-carbon coupling, would they evolve? They can also be neglected, but for a different effect. So carbon-carbon couplings can be 50 hertz. So they are large, and one-third of the proton-carbon coupling. But you don't have in natural abundance samples, you don't have two carbons active at the same time. So what would that mean? So you have in a molecule, you have such a fragment, and that is 99% and 99% abundant. You have a fragment where this carbon is 13C, so it's 1%. You have a fragment where this carbon is 13C, so that's also 1%. And the molecule where the two carbons are at the same time isotope labeled is 1% of 1%. These four identical molecules differing only in their isotopic pattern are called isotopomers. Yeah? And isotopomers you not only need in NMR, but also in mass spectrometry. For example, PROM. Was it PROM? I think it was PROM, has 33% of 33% of one isotope and 33% of another one. So you basically get mixtures of masses if you look at mass spectrometry of PROM-containing molecules. So the majority of your molecules show no signal. No signal in heteronuclear correlation experiments because the carbons are not active. This isotopomer shows a peak in an HSQC, in a 1J, because there is this coupling between the directly bound proton to the carbon. Yeah? This one here shows a peak in the HMBC because they share a 2J coupling, and it also would show a peak in the HSQC. And such situations where two carbons are attached, and 13C, they are used in experiments called inadequate or adequate. And you can imagine if you do that, if you can do experiments where you can connect one carbon to the other carbon, this is really, really nice, because you can actually go from one carbon to the next one, to the next one, to the next one, and that actually gives you your carbon-carbon connectivity of an organic molecule. This is, you make organic molecules by making carbon-carbon bonds, and the experiment that where you can actually trace whether you have correctly synthesized your carbon-carbon bonds is an inadequate. So it's a great experiment, but you only 1/10,000th of each molecule you put in the NMR is actually inadequate active. Which means that people, when they try to do this inadequate, they actually put gram quantities of a natural product into the NMR tube to get a signal. But then they got a signal, and you know it's a very important experiment. Okay, do you have questions? So we summarized here that we have to calculate the effect of HC coupling for this period delta. So we get minus HY cosine pi JCH delta plus 2 times HX CZ sine pi JCH delta. We set delta to 1 over 2JCH, which gives minus HY cosine pi half plus 2HX CZ sine pi half. The cosine is for 90 degrees is 0. The sine of 90 degrees is 1. So we actually get this state of magnetization. And I want to discuss again this state of magnetization, because it's actually quite striking and not entirely easy to understand. what happens now, kind of fundamentally. I assign in the coordinate system the x's and y's in a little different way than we used to do. So I put just the minus y in the right corner, but it's still going anticlockwise around. So our proton here is the 1% of my sample that gives signal. In this 1%, my proton is coupled to a 13C. So it has a 1J coupling. Where do I see such a signal in the NMR spectrum when I do a 1D? You always see it if you look carefully. So if you, for example, look at the peak of chloroform at 7.23 ppm, then left and right to zeros approximation equally spaced, you have two peaks that have an intensity of 0.5 and 0.5. And so the central peak, as you remember, is the proton in chloroform that is bound to 12C. So this is H12C. That comes 99% in the sample. That is 99% of the sample. And those two smaller peaks come from the 1% in the sample where carbon is 13C. And these signals are called satellites. Satellite peak. And they are split in a doublet because there is, is there something you don't see? It's okay. They are split by a doublet because they have a CH coupling. For chloroform, by the way, 250 hertz. But we don't need to know that. So in first approximation, this peak is then 125 hertz shifted downfield of the central peak. So the left satellite is on plus 125, and the right satellite is minus 125. And just for curiosity, I tell you, but you don't really have to really know this, but when you really calculate it, you might find deviations from what I state. It can be that this guy is probably shifted a little more to the left, so probably 128 hertz. And then this guy is shifted only 122 hertz to the right. And this comes from the fact that the chemical shift of a proton when bound to 12C doesn't have to be identical to the chemical shift of a proton bound to 13C. So there is an isotope shift in the chemical shift. And there are primary isotope effects of directly bound, so proton bound directly to carbon 12 or 13, gives an isotope shift of 3 hertz. And there are also secondary isotope shifts. Proton bound either to carbon 13 two bonds away or 12C carbon 13 two bonds away. And these are 0.3 or whatever hertz. They're smaller. So these satellites don't exactly have to be identical position left and right. They can be a little shifted. And that's due to a chemical shift isotope effect. Okay, but that's, just for curiosity, you have heard this. Okay, so these are the two peaks, these 0.5% that we barely see in a 1D. I mean, you have analyzed all the 1Ds in the practical works that you have analyzed thus far. You never looked into the 0.5% peaks, but these are the peaks that give rise to the correlation. And so the yellow peak, the yellow proton peak, has the carbon in the alpha state, and the blue peak has the carbon in the beta state. So for my proton, I have two vectors with carbon either in the alpha or in the beta state. The radius of my circle is 0.5. And the circle actually represents transverse proton magnetization. So this is my starting state. And then it evolves for delta. I obtain HXCZ. And in the vector diagram, this state is represented by the two vectors pointing in opposite direction. So you remember here, at this point in time, the magnetization is in phase. We can see, we can detect the signal. And here, it is antiphase. This state doesn't send out any RF. Or even better to state, the yellow part of this state sends out RF probably in this direction, and the blue part sends out RF exactly opposite direction. And because the two states are coherent, which means if the yellow is plus 90, then the blue is minus 90, strictly, they are coherent. That means that the two RFs, that the two subfractions of my state sent out cancel. Yeah? Now I apply what happens with the two 90-degree pulses. Phase Y on proton, 90-degree pulse phase X on carbon. And that converts, so you take this one. So Y on X gives minus 2HZ. X on Z gives minus Y magnetization. Okay, now how do we describe this state in terms of these vectors? Now we have carbon transfers. So it's carbon transverse. The length of the vector, or the radius of the circle, is now gamma c divided by gamma h times 0.5. So it's 1/4 of 0.125. And it is antiphase. It's antiphase. Now my coordinate system looks like this. But now it is proton alpha and proton beta state. Before here, it was carbon beta and carbon alpha states and protons transverse. Now it is carbon transverse and protons alpha beta. Yeah. So you have generated by this pulse, by the two pulses, you have generated a coherence transfer. The protons have been transversed before the two pulses. Now the carbons are transverse. The carbons were either alpha and beta, or beta. And now the protons are either alpha and beta. But the system knows that coherence, coherently. It's memory. It's still present. It's not a random alpha beta assignment, but the one spin that was alpha before on protons goes to alpha beta carbons. Okay. Now we are at point D, and what we have now at point D is 2HZCY. And now we have an element T1/2, delta pulse on protons T1/2 between D and E. And again, we have to look what happens. What happens for proton chemical shift, for carbon chemical shift, for heteronuclear coupling, for proton-proton homonuclear coupling. Now we have here a situation, and what we now have here as start is a state 2HZCY. So carbons are transverse and not protons. So whether or not the 180 degree pulse does anything on the protons is not relevant because the protons are not transverse. So it doesn't matter what it does because it's irrelevant. Protons are not transverse. There is no 180 degree pulse on the carbon, so chemical shift evolves for carbon. Evolves for T1. There's 180 degree pulse on the protons, so proton carbon coupling is refocused. Proton proton couplings is irrelevant because the protons are not transverse. Brackets. You see that this paper with, you know, the effects of pulses on these interactions. This is in order to understand NMR pulse sequences. This is what you do on and on and on and on. You just think about what happens. But on the other hand, if you know that, you can design pulse sequences, how you correlate spins. It's very easy. But you have to be, you have to know that, these alphabets. So what we have to do now by this analysis between points D and E is to see what is the effect of carbon chemical shift for time T1. So we get 2HZ CY cosine omega C T1 plus C, sorry, minus CX sine omega C T1. Danke. So this is where we are at point E. And then we apply a 90 degree pulse phase Y on protons and a 90 degree pulse from X on carbon. Y on Z gives plus X. X on Y gives Z, gives Z. Y, X on X does nothing. So this is what we get. I write this out again and abbreviate cosine with a C and sine with an S. Can you still see this? Kann man das noch sehen? So I have here this antiphase, now again proton transverse, carbon longitudinal. So we are back here, proton transverse, carbon longitudinal. And I have such a weird signal HXCX. This is called double and quantum zero, double and zero quantum coherence, and cannot be detected. And for today, we leave it at this information. Yeah. So we leave it at this information. So we only have to care for the first term, for this term. Point F, we have 2hx zz cosine omega ct1, and now we have to calculate the effect between F and G, and you see that B and C and F and G are identical, the pulses. So the inept and the reverse inept the same interactions evolve. So I don't repeat what I said for the inept because it is identical. You just have to look two pages back. So it is 2 pi j ch hz cz delta. And delta is set to 1 over 2 j, which means that I refocus. I refocus the coupling. I get Hy modulated by cosine omega ct1 at point H. And now in T2, chemical shift evolves, now of protons, and I have this box that is called decoupling, and this decoupling box decouples the proton carbon J coupling during T2. So I only have the chemical shift, so I get a signal that is described by cosine omega c t1 times e to minus t1 divided by t2 of carbon times e to the power of I omega h t2 times e to the power of minus T2 small t2 capital T2 of proton. So I again have a signal. You remember probably what we discussed with Nosy, where in T2 I have a complex signal And in T1, I only have a cosine modulated signal. So in order to fully then describe the experiment, I have to do something to get sine discrimination in T1. And in order to get sine discrimination in T1, you can probably tell me which pulse I have to shift. That is probably a tough question, but in principle it's very easy, but you have to remember what we did to get sine discrimination in the NOSI. And you probably remember, I try to one by one explain how we get to this point. Here I have an X pulse, and that generates CY magnetization. And so the CY part is cosine modulated, and the CX part is sine modulated. And the second 90 degree pulse on carbon selects either the cosine or the sine component. Here it selects the cosine component, converts it into CZ, and the sine component is lost. Now, if I now want to get the cosine component, what do I have to do? If I now want to get the sine, the other component, the sine component, danke, the sine component, what do I have to do? Tassilo will das sagen, weil wir es aber noch erstmal absichern. Sagen Sie einfach. Ja. At the beginning or at the end or it doesn't matter. If we apply here a Y pulse, we get CX. And then it's Cx cosine, Cy sine. And if this is x, then we select out the sine component. If we keep this x and put this to y, then we keep this one, but we will also select the sine component. So it actually doesn't matter whether you shift the 90 degree pulse before or after the evolution period. You can shift either of the two. It's admittedly complex, the question. It's admittedly complex, but in principle it is easy. But you have to, I mean, you have to get used to this kind of thinking. It's not something that you do all the time. So I say second experiment with pulse by for sine discrimination. Can sine discrimination? It's probably not very nicely written. For sine discrimination, discussed this in the NOSI, so I'm not going to calculate all the effects. So this is what I have in the first experiment, and in the second experiment. I get the sine modulated component. The two experiments are combined. Gives e to the power I omega c t1 e minus t1 divided by capital T2 carbon times e to I omega h t2 times e to minus t small letter t2 capital letter t2 proton. And the Fourier transform of that signal gives a signal of two frequencies, and that's the correlation peak, where on the y-axis I have omega carbon divided by 2 pi. On the x-axis I have omega proton divided by 2 pi. And that's the proton chemical shift. And that's the carbon chemical shift. And so the HSQC, the 2D experiment, is significantly more sensitive. So if you want to get the signal of a carbon, you run an HSQC because it's way more sensitive. First point. Second point, you get for free the carbon chemical shift. And once you have assigned the protons, you get the carbon chemical shift for free. I say that repeatedly. The synthetic guys, be they in organic or inorganic or other branches of chemistry, they ask their students to run a carbon 1D. This carbon 1D runs for 4 or 8 hours. The HSQC gives more signal to noise in 15 minutes, and you get more information. But still, the synthetics, they want the carbon 1D, which makes absolutely no sense, but they still insist on this. Why do they sometimes want to have the carbon 1D? Because, of course, you have quaternary carbons. Quartäre Kohlenstoffe, quaternary carbons, they don't have a proton. So then you don't see this HSQC. But then we say, if you have run your carbon 1D, if you really insist on this, for 8 hours, then just run another 10 minutes experiment in addition to it. And then you get more signal to noise, you see more, and you get even the chemical shift. But then, of course, it becomes more complicated, and that's one of the threats. In the 1D, you have this 1D peaks, and in the 2D, you have a 2D. So, and that's also why we actually put these 2D experiments very much in the beginning of the practicum. And as you may know, we also got money from Fonds der Chemischen Industrie. We applied for money, and we were one of three selected projects, and now there is an NMR spectrometer with a sample changer in the practicum. So now all the compounds can be actually analyzed by 2D, 1D, 2D NMR, because with a sample changer, this is what makes a difference. Because now at the end of your practical work, you can place all your samples in the sample changer, and then the spectra run overnight because you don't need manual interference setting up an NMR experiment. You just put it into a sample changer and then the night works. And by the way, there's no more charge. I mean, the charge for an NMR is to get this liquid helium, the liquid nitrogen. But whether you pulse in NMR spectrometer or not, the electric current you use for having the console on is the same as if you pulse. So it's really, it's also no additional costs involved. I mean, the cost you have anyway, whether you run the experiment or whether you don't run the experiment. I mean, you have the cost for the solvent and for the tubes. So HSQC should be done routinely, and at least in practicum we can now also exercise this. These are all the two. So we have discussed in detail two 2D pulse sequences, namely a NOSI as an example of a homonuclear experiment, and such HSQC as example for an heteronuclear experiment. This is all what we do in terms of going through all these operators in the lecture. In the practicals, in the exercises, you calculate COSY as an exercise, but that's all what we do in terms of calculating all these operators. What we do now, from now on, is to discuss how do you get information from NMR and what kind of information do you get? Yeah? I mean, how do you get distances? How do you get diffusion constants? How does a Kernspin tomogram, magnetic resonance imager works? Yeah? And what kind of information do you get from NMR? But I thought, or we think that this block that we had of some 6 or 8 lectures in getting into the theory of NMR actually helps you to understand all these experiments. And that's it for today. It's a little shorter than usual. Thank you.